Welcome to this Today's Football Times podcast brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Today's Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. As the domestic season is heading towards the finishing straight, today we're going to be discussing relegation and promotion across the league, so plenty of positives and negatives, and the negatives are not just going to be about my Newcastle United, thankfully. Joining me today are a few of our usual suspects. Firstly, a fan of a club less familiar than most with the perils of relegation. Everton's last demotion coming in the early 1950s, I think. So they have had one or two scrapes since then, but survived in the top flight ever since. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Aidan. Thanks for having me on the show again. Yeah, it was the 50-51 season, and we were down in Division 2 for three seasons, and we came back up again 53-54, the same season that Liverpool got relegated. That's never going to happen again, is it?
Never say never. Never. Also from the lower reaches of this season's championship, looking anxiously over his shoulder with the current travails of his beloved Birmingham City, is Matthew Gibbs. Evening, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I think this is the fifth season in six that we're locked in a relegation battle. So I think I'm a bit of an expert on it at this point.
Yes, we've got the right man on the pod here when it comes to the relegation struggles. I mean, you and me both, Matthew. It's not just you. Don't worry. And also from north of the border, hoping for a return to the top flight after 4 years away for Inverness Cali, is Lewis Henderson. Evening, Lewis.
Evening, Aidan. Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to this one. Just after recording, we've had a televised North of Scotland derby where Inverness won, so got to get my Inverness mention in there somewhere. So really looking forward to this one.
Well, exactly. And you can have all the positivity that Matthew and I don't have. So there we go. But we'll start with the English Premier League then. Ignoring whatever tussles are going on nearer the top, which, you know, as a fan of Newcastle, I pay very little attention to at times. In some seasons, though, the greater interest in the final few weeks can often come nearer the bottom, with the teams becoming increasingly desperate, of course, in their bid to survive. So I guess while Sheffield United are pretty much long gone, West Brom edging closer, although they've had an incredible victory away at Chelsea this weekend, Chelsea's incredible defence being breached five times, no less. But the scrap for survival is down to probably three or perhaps just two teams to decide who's likely to join those. Fulham and Newcastle obviously being chief amongst them. Brighton, possibly to an extent, but they seem to be easing away now. So two of those three teams I just mentioned there, Fulham, Newcastle and Brighton, showing some form and fight, whereas one generally hasn't been over recent weeks, though a little more positive today. We'll come on to Newcastle in a moment more specifically, though. But firstly, Paul, if we talk Fulham, looking back to the start of the season, having come up through the playoffs on a short turnaround, perhaps it was understandable they would struggle initially, but they've had some good results lately, being on a much better run. Today aside, they lost to Aston Villa the day we're recording on the Sunday, but they have given themselves a great chance to stay up. And regardless of how it actually turns out in the end, is this a case of good management and organisation bearing fruit eventually, and a bit of a lesson in not jumping to conclusions too early in the season?
Yeah, I mean, I think Fulham learned from previous experience, haven't they? Because the last time they went down, they had three managers in one season, I think. They sacked Claudio Ranieri, didn't they? They sacked the German manager as well. So I think they've been through that scenario before. Yeah, I mean, I think they did right to stick by Scott Parker, because when you looked at that squad, you just didn't think there's no strength and depth or skill or talent there to keep them in the Premier League. I think Scott Parker has done a really good job just to keep them in contention for not going down. I think today's result was a really bad blow for them. I mean, when you're fighting the drop, if you take a 1-0 lead with 20 minutes to go, then you're really looking to try and see that game out and come away with the 3 points. And you could just see that their heads really went down once they let Villa get the equaliser, and there's only going to be one team winning it after that. And I always think resilience is a really important quality and factor in teams that are trying to avoid the drop, that they don't let their heads go down when they concede an equaliser. And I think I saw in Newcastle today, aside those very resilient. And at the moment, I think, you know, my money would be on Newcastle rather than Fulham. I don't know about you, Wayne. Now, I would say possibly this season, 35 points might be enough to keep a team up, given there's only six or seven fixtures to go for most of the clubs. Newcastle have a game in hand on Fulham as well. So really, you know, I think if Newcastle win three out of the remaining eight games, as far as I can see, they're safe. Fulham arguably got slightly easier running. I think for both parties' sake, you don't want, well, Sky Sports would differ on this, but for both parties' sake, you don't want the last game of the season to be a relegation decider for either side, particularly fans allowed back in as well, because I think that would give Fulham an advantage in that game in particular. So personally, I think Scott Parker's done well to keep Fulham in contention. Deserves to be kept in position for next year and rebuild again. But my money at the moment is definitely on Fulham going down.
You said there, Paul, got to pick you up on this. If Newcastle win three out of the remaining eight, they've won two out of 20.
Yeah, but and they're doing against Everton, weren't they? But yeah, but you look at Newcastle's running aid. I mean, you got Burnley away. Burnley are struggling a little bit at the moment. You've got Sheffield United at home, which surely has to be a gimme. Surely has to be 3 points. You've got Arsenal home. I mean, I'd back anyone against Arsenal these days. So, and I say, I mean, you might not even need three wins. I mean, 34 points could be enough to keep somebody up this season. So, you know, the days of 40 points to stay in the Premier League, I think, are long gone. And you know, with four home games, you'd like to think they could win two out of four, and that would be enough, I think.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I mean, it's certainly in terms of managers and how they're doing. We talked there of Scott Parker. He's certainly instigated better methods, and he's getting more out of his team than the Newcastle manager is, regardless of, you know, who actually ends up surviving. I think given the circumstances of how they've, you know, coming up through the playoffs is traditionally awkward for teams to prepare for the top flight, of course, perhaps even more so this time with the length of time in between their playoff victory and the start of the Premier League. But I think he's showing that, you know, he's got some quality as a manager.
Yeah, possibly. I know there's a certain mindset in the part of the world where you live in as you got Steve Bruce, but I think one thing you cannot hold against him is he's got experience of being in relegation battles. And I think it's the time like this that you need an experienced manager who knows how to get the team over the line. I think as well, Callum Wilson coming back will make a big difference to Newcastle's game plan as well. So, in an ideal world, Steve Bruce would not be there for the start of next season. But I think he's got enough about him to keep them up this season. Scott Parker, as we said, did really well to get Fulham out of the Championship and to keep them in contention. But as I stated at the start of this conversation, my money would be on Steve Bruce over Scott Parker.
Now, we mentioned Brighton briefly. I know they're a little bit out of the way of all of this mess now. But they're another club with a clear philosophy and direction. It's been, you know, it's been a little bit of a struggle at times this season, but their recent 3-0 win over Newcastle, I mean, the difference between the teams there was an apparent chasm rather than just a single league place. I'll come to you, Matthew, on this one. Do you think they, and Fulham possibly to an extent too, they bust the sort of long-standing view that maybe it is the school that Bruce belongs to and Allardyce equally, in order to battle relegation, you've got to play in a different, more straightforward way, you know, fighting rather than sticking to your more ideal philosophy? And West Brom, they changed from possibly what was a philosophy into the old school approach, seeking to survive with Allardyce, and it looked to have been completely backfiring. But who knows what difference their victory this weekend will have, even though they possibly seem a bit too far behind. So, well, I guess one question is, can they possibly escape from the position they're in? But really, the main question is, do the old relegation battle stereotypes no longer apply if teams are not succeeding through this battling way and are succeeding through sticking to their more ideals?
Yeah, it's an interesting point, because I think it comes down a lot to like resilience, as we've said. If you play in a quite defensive manner, if you go out into games looking to, you know, not to lose, you just, at the most you want to draw, it's really difficult to sustain that over 38 games, where if you're looking to go a bit more offensively, a bit more like Brighton do, where you press the game and try and control the game a little bit more, like a bit more possession based, that is well, feasibly a bit more sustainable. But Brighton deserve a lot of credit for the way they play. I think it's really brave, a bit like Fulham. It's really brave to play that type of football when you're staring relegation in the face. They just lack goal scorers. Both teams lack goal scorers, which is what everybody lacks, isn't it? But I will say that Brighton do provide a source of humour with having something silly like 30 shots every game and never seeming to score. I think Graham Potter is in the same bracket as Ralph Hasenhüttl at Southampton, where they could arguably fail to take their clubs any further. Brighton theoretically could get relegated. And yet I think because of the way he plays football, he's assistant manager, he could end up at a better job. Like, he could end up at a top half club because it's the type of football that suits big clubs with better players, frankly. But I think Brighton will be okay. I remain slightly unconvinced by Fulham. I think today highlighted that they were in control for most of the game against Villa and sort of threw it away at the end, where Villa were quite poor, but were just more ruthless than Fulham and deserved the win in the end. But I think Brighton will be okay. I do worry for Fulham. I think they may not make it. Yeah.
Well, you're all rather more optimistic about my team than I am, that has to be said. But let's get into the Newcastle thing.
Go on. I think the point of that is that I think Fulham have only won 5 games all season. They've been dropping a lot of points in winnable fixtures against West Brom, against Palace, against Newcastle, where Newcastle, I don't know how they do it. I really do not understand this Newcastle at all. I don't understand this Steve Bruce at all. But they just seem to pick up random surprise results, like today against Spurs. It was not really on the cards, and yet they were arguably the better team for some of the game. But Fulham don't seem to be able to hold on to leads and don't seem to be able to pick up all important wins. They just sort of they draw too many games, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, you talked there about Newcastle picking up unlikely results, and that's something that, you know, earlier in the season, they probably did that more regularly and they sat mid-table, and not really bothering anyone above them or below them at that time. But what that hid was the fact that the warning signs were there for anyone who was willing to see them. The poor performances were either haphazard plans or seemingly at times non-existent plans, and certainly non-adaptable plans. Since Christmas time, those results, to me, the odd aberration like Everton aside, they've more accurately reflected the performances, in my opinion. And you know, you talk about regressing to the mean or something like that. It's I think the position became a more natural one for the actual level of performance they had all season. So now we see the trouble they're in. And you mentioned there, what were you saying there, Matthew, about going for a draw 38 times in a season, more or less. It's just too much. So Newcastle, their tactics and approach, this is where a lot of the problem is. So going away to Sheffield United, to a team at that stage you hadn't won at all in the league, so far. Newcastle go there seeking to grab a 0-0 draw and they end up lose. Then they go to West Brom, seek to do the same, and they just about hold on. Then, more recently, they go to Brighton to try and do exactly the same, and it ends up spectacularly failing. Now, Lewis, I'll come to you with this one. As a general point, I know we've talked about Newcastle at length on other pods, but to me, as a Newcastle fan, for a team who's desperate for wins, to not even try to get them against the teams who are below you currently or just one place above in Brighton's case, to me, that's absolutely incredible. If you don't think you can beat those teams, just who do Newcastle think they can beat to get the necessary points? I mean, am I too blinkered in this, or is this negative approach coming through to everyone else as well?
No, I'm very much on your side in terms of the Newcastle train of thought, and whether that's because I've been influenced by talking to you so much about Newcastle, I'm not entirely sure.
But glad to hear it.
What I would say is that the issue with Newcastle is that there's no plan. There's no like with Graham Potter's Brighton, we talk about a well-coached side that we can see an upward trajectory for that side. Obviously, we talk about there is the possibility of relegation, but realistically, I don't think too many of us would be surprised if next season Potter remains at Brighton, a few astute signings, and they climb up the table, because as Matthew mentioned, it's quite comical sometimes the amount of chances they don't put away. It only takes one absolutely fantastic striker, for example, for Brighton's fortunes to completely change. That's something that we don't see at all with Newcastle, and I would be seriously questioning someone's judgment if they could honestly say to me, next season, if Newcastle stay as they are, you can see them climbing up the table. Because I think even if they do survive this season, there is serious issues at that club that need to be rectified. Otherwise, they will go down next season. In terms of, I think, we talk about pandemic football and how much the lack of fans has changed the dynamic of football. I think it might well have saved Newcastle's season, because there is absolutely dross results for on the most part, and the football is absolutely atrocious. So you can only imagine the atmosphere, which was already incredibly toxic due to Ashley's sort of stewardship at St. James's, what that would be like with the absolutely terrible football that's being played at the moment. And I mean, I was doing a bit of research sort of beforehand in terms of Steve Bruce, and we're sort of talking about it there. The Newcastle Evening Chronicle did a poll, and 95% of the people who participated wanted him out. So I think that speaks volumes about the toxicity at the club. There's no forward thinking there. And I don't think, whether it's this season or next season, if things don't change, I would have them for favourites as relegation. And I mean, we know Mike Ashley like has a reputation as a gambler, but I mean, even by his standards, which are questionable at best, he's taking such a risk keeping Bruce in charge of this squad and not investing in it as much as he should.
I think it all goes back to the actual appointment of Steve Bruce, though, which when they appointed him, he'd been knocking around the Championship for a few years and clearly on the decline as a manager. And yet they signed Joel Linton for 40 million the week after. And then a month later, he's talking about how he was brought in to fight relegation after the club has just spent 40 million on a new striker. That's not the right mindset to come in to have. That's not how he should be. So I think straight from the start, you come in with like this negative mindset that you know he's going to come in and play this dour defensive football. It's just from the start, you're fighting a losing battle. And then last season when Newcastle overperformed with their XG and got results that they shouldn't really have got, they don't learn from that. And this season is exactly the same story. And if Newcastle stay up, it won't be because they've played well. It'll be because other teams have failed, like Fulham. So it's exactly going to be the same story next season, I think.
That's precisely what we're counting on, Matthew, is other teams being worse. And that's the only way. A lack of a plan. And you talk there about Joel Linton, and then you can add to that, you know, last summer's recruitment seemed good on the face of it with Callum Wilson especially, and a couple of other decent squad players, I would say. But he was obviously the standout, and the way he works with St. Maximin. Brian Fraser. Yeah, decent player. And there was Jamal Lewis as a fullback who's got good prospects and so on. You know, this is improving the squad. You know, there's been lots of comparisons of how Benitez was achieving with Newcastle and how, you know, it was not particularly that much better than Bruce. And I would argue the toss that it was definitely better than Bruce. And also it was with far less resource in terms of quality.
Newcastle have a decent squad. Like, they definitely don't have a squad that's in the bottom three of the division. I think they've got a better squad than West Brom and Palace and arguably Southampton. But I think that a decent squad is just pure mismanagement.
Totally. And Steve Bruce, he's lost the dressing room a long, long time ago, and there's been all sorts of incidents and so on behind the scenes. He seems to hang people out to dry frequently, but, you know, there's absolutely no thought whatsoever of a replacement from the club. And, you know, if it was going to happen, it would have happened in the fairly swift aftermath of that Brighton game, which went into the international break. And if it's not going to happen then it simply isn't going to happen. So he's going to see the season out.
Graham Jones is coming as assistant manager now. So has he made a difference since he's come in? Has he kind of been brought in as like an additional sort of level between the players and the management? And is Graham Jones being lined up to take Steve Bruce's job even when he goes?
Well, I mean, on that last part, I don't know. I mean, in terms of the influence and so on, he was widely praised when Newcastle beat Southampton about 6 weeks or so ago, which was a battling performance when Newcastle were down to 10 men as well. And they saw that one through. Hugely vital result. But that came, you know, a week or so after he'd been appointed. So he got all the praise rather than Bruce, naturally, for his influence. He seems, you know, a bit more of a talker in terms of giving the direction and guidance from the sidelines that, you know, Benitez did hugely. And Bruce is not so tactically astute, I don't think. So maybe there's a little more there. In terms of long-term replacement, I don't know. And that would suggest that they have a plan. And, you know, all evidence of the previous decade would point me to the fact that there is never much of a plan. So I would put that well beyond Mike Ashley and the other leadership at the club. But yes, we'll see how that turns out. But, you know, I am not optimistic. But then who would be when you're a fan, when it's your club down there? Yeah, most people are not optimistic.
Exactly.
But let's get a bit more positive now. We'll look at the teams hoping to make a step up into the Premier League. Now, the most interesting here to me the most notable anyway, is Norwich City. So this is a club who struggled in the top flight last season. And I guess as with Fulham now, and possibly Brighton too, they stuck to their philosophy, even if that meant relegation last year. There was no huge changes made on going down either. So they retained the majority of the squad. They kept the manager, Daniel Farke, and they're building on the solid base that he's set. Now they look almost certain to return to the Premier League. So Matthew, on this one, is this a lesson in how to progress as a club? You know, they didn't overspend and reach for the stars last season in a struggle to survive. They've used that experience and presumably the money to keep growing and leaving them in what now appears to be a far stronger position than they would have been in if they'd scraped survival last year. Is that fair?
I think so. But I think there's also a combination of the pandemic effect as well, because Norwich and Watford are probably the two best teams in the division. But I think they were quite lucky that there weren't other clubs who were able to buy their best players. So Norwich has, you know, you've got Cantwell, Max Ahrens and Buendia, and they managed to stave off interest because nobody had any money, or nobody had the money necessary to meet that situation. Same goes for Watford with Ismail Assar, Nathaniel Chalobah and Will Hughes, and there's a few others that are quite good players. So I think it's been a mixed bag of planning for the future and the whole like, other clubs not having money. But I think the best business Norwich did was keeping Daniel Farke, because they play the most stylish football in the division. They didn't really skip a beat from coming back down. They just carried on playing this fluid football. They may be a bit overly reliant on Timo Pukki and Emi Buendia. Between them, they have 33 goals. And the next highest scorer from them is Cantwell with 5. So they don't score that many goals, but they have a rock solid defence. They brought in Ben Gibson on loan, who's been really excellent. He picked up an injury a few weeks ago at the weekend, I can't remember. And it looks like he's out for the rest of the season, but you think they have enough about them to get them through to the end of the season.
Now, you mentioned there Watford as well. So, Lewis, I mean, Norwich and Watford both came down last season. Are they sort of demonstrating that, with all the mitigation Matthew's talking about there, of, you know, they could have had their assets stripped in different times, perhaps they would have done. But are they showing that relegation isn't really the end of the world that, you know, many a sports channel would have us believe? The club can, in fact, be better off in the long term by maintaining the sort of steady curve of development rather than merely trying to cling on, or am I reading too much into it?
No, I absolutely agree in terms of Sky and the like will let us believe that the Premier League is the only league in the world that exists. So God forbid you fall out of it. But I see a season and a project and a team can't be defined by, I don't think it necessarily be defined by relegation. It means different things to different teams. So for example, we talk about Newcastle, and it is a bit of a catastrophe if they go down, because is that site, is there an idea there? Is there a plan? Is there a philosophy for that side to necessarily come back up? Probably not. Whereas a team like Norwich, we've talked about it already, they've kept a manager who has already taken the side up before, playing a brilliant brand of football. Where if we mentioned the likes of Timo Pukki, Max Ahrens, Todd Cantwell, these are all Premier League quality players. Much of that core of the side that took them up the first time is there again, and some of the highlights from that Premier League season are still there. Like, we can't underestimate the importance of like a well-managed project, and it's why it baffles me why certain sides, in terms of particularly a Newcastle, as we've mentioned, but even Sheffield United and West Brom, don't look at the bigger picture. Is very much just we need to plow everything into staying into the league, because it doesn't always work like that. And we've seen so many big sides that were mismanaged in the Premier League and were clinging on to try and stay as long as they could, but were ultimately mismanaged. I'm thinking the likes of Sunderland and Hull City, for example, who I'm sure we're going to talk about later in the pod. These sides tried to cling on and they were mismanaged for so long. It was a managerial merry-go-round. There was no real plan there. And once they went down, they plummeted down, because it doesn't work like that. The quality of Championship football is incredibly high. And if you don't go into that with a side set up correctly, it can be incredibly damaging. And it's why I think taking that managerial merry-go-round of Sam Allardyce, Steve Bruce is incredibly damaging. And also, just sort of on the Sheffield United point, we talked about them briefly. Chris Wilder is someone who really has rebuilt the club in the past sort of 5 years, that sort of period, in terms of where they were and where he took them to. And I don't know what happened at board level. There's rumours of what happened. But ultimately, albeit on an interim basis, I don't think Paul Heckingbottom is the man who can rebuild the club in the same way that Chris Wilder could. I mean, Heckingbottom, for all he was a less than inspired and really set the world alight when I seen him at Hibs. But I think you need to sometimes, you shouldn't always cut someone dry in terms of if there is that opportunity to rebuild the club. And I think it's why the decision to sack Chris Wilder was a poor one. And even if a side such as Fulham go down, having Parker at the helm, for example, he took them up the first time. There's an ideal there that he can really take them back up. And as someone who's a bit of a football romantic, there's something really nice about seeing a Norwich, for example, keep that side as it is and go again. And I think we'll see a better side ultimately when they come back up. I think they could quite easily, I think they will definitely perform better next season in the Premier League on the assumption they go up than they did the first time. And I think a lot of credit to that has to go to the fact that they stayed true to their values.
And in terms of club building for Brentford, a couple of places down in the league, but still fighting for promotion. Now, they're a model club in many respects. I mean, that in itself seems quite a bizarre comment, given how far down the chain Brentford have been in most of their history. But even in losing players after missing out on promotion at the last season, Ollie Watkins has moved up a level with some distinction. Probably the most notable there, but they're still very much in with a chance this season. It's another, I guess this is a slightly different approach, isn't it? There's a little more holistic approach here, but it's another fine example of how to run a club and reap the rewards.
Yeah, I mean, you always end up feeling permanently sorry for Brentford because you just knew last season that they would blow the automatic promotion when it came to the last two games of the season. You just didn't have that necessary, use that word, resilience or experience or know-how to get them over the line. It was actually harder not to get promoted rather than to get promoted, and somehow they contrived to do that. And you always feel a team like that that's just as giving away promotion always struggles in the playoffs. I just had no confidence that the Brentford were going to come through the playoffs. I have no confidence Brentford will come through the playoffs this season. I think they're going to be in the Championship again next season. They've already let the gap open to about 7 points now between them and Watford. And obviously from a footballing point of view, I love the style of football that they play. I love the fact that they're a strong, traditional, historic club. And I really do hope they end their playoff jinx, because it's not just in the Championship. They've blown playoffs in League One before. I think their general playoff record is quite frighteningly bad. So I think their aim this season, I'm sure, would have been to have gone for automatic promotion. It just they haven't quite had the resources to do that. You highlighted their recruitment. I mean, their recruitment has been superb, hasn't it? They sold Ollie Watkins and replaced him with Ivan Toney, who's been, what has been a revelation this season. I mean, he looked good a piece of it last season when you watched the highlights on Quest. But yeah, he's been a fantastic buy. And Thomas Frank always comes across really well. So yes, I would love them to come up. I've still got some doubts and reservations. And if we just go back to the briefly to the Norwich Watford thing, it's interesting because both clubs have adopted completely approaches to getting promotion this season. Watford's approach is always, if we're not doing as well as expected, we'll sack the manager. So they sacked Ivic in December this season because they weren't progressing in the manner they were expecting, and appointed Munoz as the new manager. They've had, I think, 10 managers in 7 years, so they almost have to. It's like a Chelsea Championship model. If things aren't working quite well, you bring in a new manager. And unlike Norwich, they sold their best players in the summer. They sold Decore. They sold De La Feu. So in some ways, their achievement is actually quite caught me by surprise, because I didn't think they quite had the resources to get them back up this season. But maybe it's more, I mean, I'm sure Matthew knows more about this than me. Maybe it's more a reflection of the maybe slightly lower quality in the Championship this season, because I don't think it helps when the top two pull away by such a significant margin, with at least 8 games of the season to go. So going back to Brentford, yeah, my model club, great new stadium, really wish them all the best. I just have a little reservation about whether they can get through the playoffs or not.
I totally agree with Paul, actually. I think Brentford have a bit of, they play really nice football and they score bags of goals, but they just have a bit of fragility about them at the back, and they're on a bit of a ropey run at the minute. There's a lot of draws and some surprise defeats. They've drawn with strugglers like Huddersfield and Derby, lost to QPR, Barnsley and Coventry, and they still haven't nailed that playoff spot. And for a team that harbours automatic promotion hopes, they've conceded 40 goals this season, which is a lot. It's a lot than quite a few other clubs in the division. So I don't think they're going to make automatics, and I really wouldn't be surprised to see them fall in the playoffs again.
Oh, this is breaking my heart. Brentford are my other club. I used to live around that way in my London years. So, oh, dearie me. I was devastated when they missed out last year. As you say, Paul, to miss out when they had all those opportunities to do it through the league position to finish second. When you drop into the playoffs, as you say, you always think it's going to go wrong. But then they reached the final, I thought it would be okay. But alas, no. But there you go. I think they just fit with the general theme of any club I support, never having a great time. Anyway, speaking of not having a great time, Matthew, I'm going to come to you on this next section again. It's down at the foot of the Championship. Perhaps unsurprisingly, I guess both Wickham and Rotherham are in the relegation mix, given the resources of those clubs compared to those around them. So I hope that doesn't sound too disrespectful, although I know Rotherham have got a few games in hand, which may help them. But what's more interesting to my eyes is a collection in the bottom half of the Championship of what really should be clubs with much greater resource and much greater potential. So we see Sheffield Wednesday deep in the mire, barely above the drop zone, are your Birmingham City. There's Coventry City and Derby County there. I think Nottingham Forest have pulled away a little bit over this weekend, and Blackburn are not too far away. Both of those latter two are probably, you know, far enough ahead to be okay and rest easy, but the others not necessarily. So Matthew, from your perspective as a Birmingham fan, I mean, how for you and your club initially, how has it come to this for your club? But equally with some of these others that really ought to be in a better position, shouldn't find themselves in such a mess given the resource that they have to hand. They really should have the capacity to set their sights rather higher than this, don't you think?
Definitely, but there's a running theme between all these clubs. You have Forest, who are run by Evangelos Marinakis, sorry, his name wrong, who's been involved with match fixing in Greece in the past. He's supposedly involved in a scandal that saw him organising which referees officiated which games. Forest have this wild squad with about 40 or 50 contracted senior players. They could field three different separate 11s if they wanted to. This absurd, mismanaged club. Same for Derby, who are a mess. They've had some long-running financial issues that's had a real impact on the squad. Sheikh Khalid, who is the cousin of Manchester City owner Sheikh Mansour, was supposed to buy the club. He was involved in the appointment of Rooney as manager, but that didn't happen. So there's been some issues with paying staff and the players. It's a real mess. Same goes for Sheffield Wednesday, who have been on a downward trajectory for a while. They've had long-running battles with the EFL, been placed under a number of transfer embargoes in the past. This season, they were deducted 12 points, which was halved to 6 points. And this weekend, the newish manager, Darren Moore, had COVID, so he missed the game, meaning they were led on the sidelines by the seventh different person this season alone. The Chancery Rain has been a disaster for Wednesday, and they deserve a lot better than what they have. And then there's Birmingham. Strap yourself in, boys. I don't even really know where to begin with Blues. Well, because we have a claim to be one of the biggest crisis clubs in the Championship, and we might still get away with it for another season. Since before we were relegated in 2011, we had three permanent managers in 14 years. Since being relegated, it's 10 in 10 years. In that decade, we've been in receivership. We've been owned by the Hong Kong police. Who actually owns the club now isn't exactly clear. There's a lot of known and unknown players, so it's really complicated to explain. This season, there's been some uncertainties around our academy structure. We've lost a ton of young talent. And last week, our stadium was sold to a mysterious buyer, with the club refusing to talk to the local press about it. Our current CEO is a guy called Don Gren, who is about as weird as they come. Keeps the actual League Cup trophy from 2011 on his desk. Regularly attends training sessions in full kit. Was fined by the EFL for verbally abusing match officials. And then when Karanka was sacked early this month, there were reports that Don Gren held a birthday party for himself and forced Karanka to attend despite having just fired him. He has this catalogue of awful decisions behind him, and I really don't understand how he's still part of the structure. On the pitch, we appointed Karanka last season, and initially me and a lot of other Blues fans were fairly positive about it. Doesn't play the most glamorous football, but it felt like a solid appointment at least. And we hoped it would, you know, a season without a relegation battle, but how wrong we were. From the start, it just didn't work. After he was appointed, there was radio silence from the club for like 4 weeks. No interview with Karanka or anything, which just felt like a very weird start. And I know having like a guy like Don Gren around doesn't makes it difficult for anybody to succeed, but it's difficult to articulate how disastrous Karanka was. The football was just so dour. We'd have games in a row where we wouldn't have a shot, and he himself was quite uninspiring. A lot of fans complained about his body language and post-match comments. We brought in 14 players, and yet the same players who play are the ones that we've had for years. He was in charge of 36 championship games and won 8. It was just an absolute disaster. the club were absolutely right to sack him. Dongi's still around though and was rumoured to be walking around the stadium publicly declaring that he hoped we lose Lee Bowyer's first game in charge because the board went over his head to remove Garanga and appoint Bowyer. And we have fans actively campaigning against Dong, hiring planes to fly over stadiums and plastering small heaps where the stadium is located with Dong out billboards. But now we have Lee Bowyer, who I was a bit unconvinced by when we first appointed him, but he has a connection to the club after winning his only major honour of his career with us in 2011. In his first three games, we've played teams in the top seven and won two. After 4 minutes against Reading in his first game, our winger picked up the ball and swung it to the back post for our big striker, Lukas Jukovic, to attack and score. And that in itself was quite damning of Karanka. We have this player who's incredible in the air, and yet we never utilised him correctly. So I think Bowyer coming in gives us a chance. We look marginally better, slightly more attacking. But as you mentioned, Rotherham have three games in hand on us. And I don't know, I worry we've left it too late.
I guess the natural reaction with games in hand is to always, you know, the natural thing for all fans is to just add on 3 points automatically, isn't it, for each game in hand. But, you know, this is Rotherham. And what really, they're not going to win three games in hand, are they? I mean, you know, they might get some points and land Birmingham a bit more bother. Perhaps, but it's a natural pessimism, isn't it, to just add on all those points and think, oh dear, we're spinning here.
Rotherham aren't a bad side, though, to be fair. They are capable of picking up points, and they had quite a nice run early on in the season that was disrupted by a lot of COVID cancellations. I don't know what they're doing in Rotherham to have so many COVID cancellations when other teams don't have any, but it's like I say, I feel slightly more positive, but I feel like it's come too late, and I worry about the rest of the season.
Moving into League One then, which hopefully Birmingham won't be doing, I guess in contrast to the struggles of some of the larger clubs near the foot of the Championship, there's a few fairly big clubs seeking to replace them at that level, or at least clubs with relatively recent top flight experience. There's Hull City top of the pile at the moment. Perhaps, though, I think the more significant themes come, well, I suppose Hull as well, but also Sunderland, and then there's Portsmouth, both having suffered to different degrees and for different reasons. Hull, Sunderland, Portsmouth, they're all now in the mixed return to the Championship. Yes, for Sunderland and Hull, this harks back to what you were saying earlier, Lewis, a catalogue of mismanagement, poor decisions that have landed them in this situation. I mean, in contrast to what we were discussing with Norwich, I suppose, they're an example of what can happen when a club's purpose for several years was little more than seeking to survive in the Premier League at the expense of a longer term vision or what may be best for the club in the long run. So I might be reading too much into it, but you know, this is kind of what you were mentioning earlier, Lewis, of the theme of mismanagement landing a club in more trouble than if they'd simply just gone down in the first place, instead of seeking to cling on year after year after year for grim death in the Premier League. I can't help but feel the rapid descent after dropping from the Premier League, in Sunderland's case particularly, anyway, and getting stuck in League One for 3 years, it is a result of this focus solely on survival and short-termism. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, it seems to be the more and more money that's been plugged into the Premier League, the shortism of, like, the short-term views of the club seem to have gotten, like, shorter and shorter almost. And it is absolutely baffling. It is why I will credit sides like Brighton and Norwich to the high heavens almost, because it needs to be having that level of that cool head to sit back and think further than the next six games or however long. It's something that really needs to be admired. And I think the clubs we're talking about is that short-termism and that mismanagement that we're talking about is just being so prevalent. Like, I think Hull and Sunderland are probably two clubs who are brilliant examples. I mean, Sunderland, we only need to look at the Ellis Short just before he left, and the constant chopping and changing of managers, the last day saviours in the Premier League for so many seasons. And then obviously after that he left, and we have the Stuart Donald catastrophe. And I mean, it was so ridiculous that it was a documentary on Netflix and one of the most popular ones at that. I think that really epitomises the absolute mess of that club in terms of it genuinely felt like a documentary based on the UK office at one point with the Brentisms from some of the senior management. It's baffling to think they're running a football club. But that mismanagement at board level, it does trickle down. And people talk a lot about how the teams in the Premier League, the gap is getting shorter and shorter. I think that absolutely applies to the Championship as well. And I sort of said it earlier, if these sides are getting better and you're mismanaged and getting worse, you definitely can't assume anymore that just because you've come down, you're going to go straight back up. And sides such as QPR, Hull City, Sunderland, Portsmouth have shown that if your club is not in order, things will go wrong. And I mean, sometimes it can be just so mismanaged that it almost gets to a point where it's a bit irrelevant in terms of, like, I think for Sunderland, to use them as a case study, in League One, they had Jack Ross as manager. Obviously, Jack Ross, someone I'm quite familiar with in terms of being from North of the Border, and someone who I think is a really good manager. And you only have to look at what he's doing at Hibernian this season. And you could just see the absolute mess at the club, whether you're watching as a football fan or, as I say, the catastrophe of a Netflix documentary, just in terms of the sheer mess that club's in. And it's almost too late to get in a competent manager if everything above him's incompetent. And again, Hull City are another brilliant example of that. The Alam family have come under so much criticism for all that they've done in terms of... I remember we're actually talking about Steve Bruce, someone who was very vocal about his issues at the club and how he felt about the management. And we'll remember the season where they went down, where he left just before the season started, and it was about 13 players available for most of pre-season. And the whole Hull Tigers bizarre thing that was going on in the badge for a while. And it's just like, if there's issues like that coming out and the mismanagement there, it's a little surprise that these clubs come back down. And it's why I worry for a club like Newcastle, because we think, oh, Newcastle, we think of that side with the iconic entertainers and one of, in terms of fan base and history, one of the biggest clubs in the league without a doubt. But it only takes so many years of mismanagement and questionable managers, such as, well, we're talking about Sunderland and Hull City, and I don't want to blame him for it personally, but Steve Bruce was in charge of both of those, wasn't he? So it's, if you go for that managerial merry-go-round and do the exact same things that these clubs are doing, which Mike Ashley is doing with a failure to invest, something that was very common with Ellis Short and the Alam family, it's why I worry for a club like Newcastle not to come straight back up, in the same way that if Brighton were more closer in this relegation battle, I wouldn't worry for them so much, because I think they're an incredibly well-run club that would come straight back up. And I think the sheer cockiness of these clubs in terms of the high-level management is really worrying for the fans of these clubs, because ultimately it's them who suffer.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point. And on Sunderland, I think they're, with their new ownership, it all seems rather more positive, much as that may hurt me to admit. They seem to be very much on the right path after these years of sliding. And, you know, I think they'll get their promotion this season and will probably be quite strong in the Championship next year. And whether they have to play Newcastle or not is another matter. I mean, another club in and around this area is Portsmouth, who obviously they've had their own financial troubles rather deeper than Sunderland's and Hull's, and the rise has obviously taken rather longer. It's quite a slow climb back up for them, and perhaps in their case, stepping up to the Championship, if they would make it, would be a bit too much of a step so far. You know, it's been a fairly steady progression. But there's other clubs.
Go back to Pompey, I think they made a really good appointment in the Cowley brothers. You know, Eden is on a short-term contract to the end of the season, and I think, you know, that race for promotion from League One is probably more exciting than the Championship at the moment. You've got three teams tying for the top position, and you've got the playoff teams not that far behind them either. And I think Portsmouth, you know, with the support, with the fan base, and the fact they've appointed a really good managerial team, the Cowley brothers, I think they could be surprise contenders for promotion this season, maybe by the playoffs. But possibly, I wouldn't rule them out of the automatic promotion at this stage.
No, it's certainly possible. But you know, we can add these into the whole mix. Hull, Sunderland, Portsmouth, you could add Ipswich a bit further down of clubs that have been poorly managed to one degree or another over the years, that are sort of languishing and struggling far below what their natural level would be. I mean, further down in that league, there's Wigan as well, who, you know, another recent Premier League team. Obviously, they had point deduction last season and so on, but, you know, a severe slide off the back of financial woes. And then, you know, they're struggling to stay at even that level as well. But coming to you, Matthew, I mean, the foot of League One, but also the top reaches of League Two. There's a number of clubs who sort of stands out looking through the table, who've all been in non-league relatively recently. So, I mean, the foot of League One, you've got AFC Wimbledon, of course. There's, you know, not further up in the league there, or there's Burton, Albion, Fleetwood, Accrington and so on, all coping slightly better than Wimbledon perhaps, but not so far above. And in League Two, Cambridge top of the pile, but also there's Cheltenham, Forest Green, Morecambe and so on, who are teams who are, you know, relatively recently in the non-league, but, you know, they're all pitting themselves well around the League One and League Two level and fighting. But in amongst those, you can still come back to the other theme of mismanagement. There's Bolton Wanderers in there, and Tranmere Rovers, I guess, who narrowly went down on points per game last season. But, you know, overall, there does seem to be, you know, it's been a long time since they've instigated the automatic promotion to non-league and so on, but it does seem a fairly consistent story. I mean, we'll come to the foot of the table shortly, where Barrow might be struggling more. But, you know, there's a fair number of clubs from the non-leagues, many of them former league clubs, of course, who are, you know, they then fight at the top of League Two or get into League One. It's quite a consistent theme, I think.
It is. I think it's sort of testament to how well run these clubs can be. I mean, you take someone like Forest Green Rovers, who have been run by, totally forgot his name, is it terrible? But
Dale Vince.
Dale Vince is the one. Run by Dale Vince for quite a long time, and they have their own way of doing things, but it works for them, and they've been on a steady upward trajectory. And I think looking at the top of League Two, it's interesting because a lot of the teams feel like quite shot candidates, like Cambridge are top, and they haven't really had much to shout about over recent years. Led by Paul Mullin, who they just recently renamed the stand after because he broke the long-standing record of most goals in a season by a Cambridge player. Yeah, and a special mention, I think, needs to go to a club like Morecambe, who usually are at the bottom of the league fighting against relegation, but have been reinvented under Derek Adams and have coped well after seeing one of their best players recalled from Burnley and sent out on loan again to Accrington in League One. They could make the playoffs. So, yeah, it's true. It's always a nice, well, not a nice theme. There's always a theme running through teams usually battling for relegation are ones usually mismanaged and ran into the ground by people who don't know what they're doing. And then at the other end, it's usually teams that have reinvented themselves.
And I guess down near the bottom of League Two, what had seemed certain for quite some time was that Barrow would be losing their league status after just one season. Now, you know, having fought so long to get up there, to have one season and a season, of course, in which none of their fans could see them live, that was quite a sad outcome. I mean, but three successive wins had changed that position somewhat. They're now sort of in a much healthier position. They're battling out with Southend and Grimsby at the foot of the table. But in contrast to the other team that came up with them last season, which was Harrogate Town, Barrow have had a really tough time. Now, overall, Paul, it must be really quite painful for Barrow if they do drop out of the league in these circumstances. Just one season, the fans who followed them in non-league for so long, unable to enjoy the highest season in their history.
Oh yeah, it'd be awful. I mean, I've always had a soft spot for Barrow because my dad used to work there when I was a kid growing up, and I used to have like, sounds bizarre, I used to exchange programs with young Barrow fans with my age. I've still got like a stack of Barrow films from 68 to 71 in the house somewhere, just lying around. So I've always kind of followed their fortunes a little bit. And when you look back to how they left the league, I mean, they got voted out in 1972, and technically they shouldn't have been voted out because they tied on votes with Hereford. And normally in a situation like that, if the team applying to be elected doesn't outvote the person trying to stay in post, then they shouldn't take their place. So it went to a second round of voting, and Hereford won on the second round. Now, the bizarre thing was, Hereford United hadn't even won the Southern League that season. They were runners-up. They were purely in the national eye because of the Newcastle results. Sorry to remind you about that. And there was like a momentum that at that time that teams in the north were losing their places. So Bradford Park Avenue were voted out, Southport were voted out, Workington were voted out, Barrow were voted out. So the whole tranche of teams from the old third division north lost their places to their southern counterparts. So from Barrow's point of view, to have lost their league position this season would have been so unfortunate. And I think the club made a few missteps at the start of the season, some that were within their control, some without. They were unfortunate that the manager who got them promoted, Ian Evans, left and went to Bolton. And you can see with the work he's done at Bolton, what a good manager he's proven to be at that level. They then appointed David Dunn, ex-Blackburn Rovers player, I think, who'd never managed in the league before, and that just didn't work out at all. They then appointed Michael Jolly, who'd been manager of Grimsby for one season, but didn't pull up any trees there. So they kind of went down the route of gambling on inexperience, and it didn't pay out for them. And I think they've gone back to one of their coaching staff now, Robert Kelly, who's been there all along. And he's come in. I think they won at the weekend as well. They beat Newport 2-1 at the weekend. So I think they've now won 4 out of the last 6 games. And there's a bit of a gap opening up now between Barrow and the teams in the bottom two positions. So I think if they can pull together maybe another 3-4 victories, that should be enough to keep them up. And for the supporters who've waited for nearly the best part of 38, 39 years to see their team playing in the Football League, to have had that snatched away from this season, just it would have just been unbearable. So I really do hope they stay up. I think they've brought us some good loan signings as well, and I'm confident that they're playing away at Colchester on Bank Holiday Monday. Now, if they were to win that game, that is going to bring Colchester right into that mix at the bottom of the table as well. So I'm hopeful that they've got enough to stay up, and I'd like to see old Football League clubs that have fallen hard times fighting their way back to the Football League again. And for a county the size of Cumbria to only have one Football League team in Carlisle, there's a whole area. And obviously, where you live in, the North East and Cumbria aren't that far apart, are they, geographically? So I just think it'd be really heartening if Barrow kept their place in League Two this season and then look to plan for a longer stay, with maybe thinking 3-4 years for a push for League One.
And as you say, yeah, their recent form, I mean, going back a month or so, they were thoroughly in the clouds, weren't they? Very much on their way out. But, you know, recent form has lifted them a good few points clear now of the two who are in the danger zone. But I'll stick with you, Paul, for the next question. Is seeking to replace them from the National League. Other than Sutton United at the top, it's almost a who's who of former league clubs. You know, it's a bit like reading a league table from 20 or 30 years ago. Hartlepool, Torquay, Stockport, Wrexham, Notts County, Chesterfield, Halifax, although I accept that's a new version of the club. But speaking of Sutton, Paul, you'll be able to remember the incident, the game I'm going to mention here. Obviously, somebody of my generation, Sutton United evoked great memories of FA Cup giant killing, beating the reigning holders at the time, Coventry City, back in 1988, I think, or 89. The football romantic in me obviously would love them to see them into the Football League purely based on that one event, because, you know, it was a huge game at the time, a huge impact that a non-league team beat the reigning FA Cup holders. I guess it's similar to what Wrexham did to Arsenal a few years later, but, you know, it was actually a bigger gap between the teams as it was at the time. Am I just being a hopeless romantic here and overly sentimental, or, you know, is that fair enough?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the Sutton definitely put themselves on the national stage with that victory over Coventry City. I think it was on Match of the Day as well, wasn't it? Because I think most people watching had a view about it. And the Sutton's manager, whose name I've forgotten, I think has since died, was given all these quotes from Shakespeare at the end of the game, and had kind of turned himself into a bit of a media personality as well. I think for people a certain age, Sutton United conjures up certain romantic memories of the giant killing days and Minnows. And I have to give them full credit for putting themselves in the situation where they are at the moment, because looking, you know, they have 16 games to go. They're clear of the top. They've got such a good chance of getting the automatic promotion place here. And as you've outlined there, they're up against some really strong sides. I mean, Hartlepool United have got probably one of the best managers in the non-league at the moment in Dave Challoner, who took Colwyn Bay from the top of the National League North at one stage. He also managed AFC Fylde and almost got them into the Football League, took them to an FA Trophy final. He's doing a great job at Hartlepool, and, you know, he's a really experienced manager. Torquay have got Gary Johnson in charge, who's managed various clubs in the Southwest, such as Yeovil Town. I think he's in charge of Cheltenham, with a good record of success as well. And there's some really experienced coaches in that division. And as you say, the following six clubs, you have Hartlepool, Torquay, Stockport, Notts County, Chesterfield, Wrexham. It's almost a third division north of old. And so for Sutton United to be above those clubs with their limited resources is a fantastic achievement. And my only slight worry for Sutton would be, the Stars are dropping one or two points in the last one or two league games. They've got quite a few fixtures to catch up upon and to cram in between now and the end of the season. My only worry would be, have they got the strength and depth in the squad to see them over the line? And if they're not going to clinch that automatic promotion place, then it's a really, really open race, I think, between Hartlepool, Torquay, and possibly Notts County, who've got a number of games in hand as well. So I think the battle to come up from National League North is fascinating. And also begs the question, why do only two teams come up from National League North? Why isn't not some consistency? Why can't three go down from League Two and three come up from National League North? Because it's just such a tough lead to get out of just by looking at the number of ex-league clubs who've been there for the best part of 10 seasons, like Wrexham, etc.
No, that's a fair point. I would even add that between... the Championship in League One should be four down and four up, yep, because it's two 24 team leagues. So just three, it doesn't seem enough when there's that many teams in the league. But that's another matter. We'll move on to Scotland now. So Lewis, we're coming your way now. The relegation from the Premiership isn't particularly exciting, but I think the greatest stories to me come in the promotion push to get into the Premiership. Now, this is being led by Hearts at the moment, which is, or at least should be, one of Scotland's bigger clubs. Lewis, what I find quite interesting about Hearts, and you know, Hibs have had time in the second tier as well. You could potentially add Dundee there too at the moment, but really it's Hearts and Hibs. They have the big city, you know, the capital city, no less, a huge catchment area. The scale of the club ought to be big, but you know, they are, of course, worlds away from the Glasgow Giants. And I know it's not geographically too far away, which is probably where the damage is, but why are the Edinburgh clubs not bigger and stronger? You know, only a week or two ago, Hearts managed to lose a cup game to Brora Rangers in the Highland League. That's a village, I know it's close to where you're from, Lewis, but it's only 2,000 or so people. This is against one of the biggest clubs from the capital city. I mean, as good as Hearts have done in the league this season, and you know, they'd have to work hard not to get promoted now, I think. But you know, the best they can hope for, really, when they go up, is just to be another of the set of clubs well behind the big two. I mean, what are your thoughts on Edinburgh clubs in general, the big two there, of why they aren't bigger?
Well, yeah, it's a big question to unpack. The Hearts one is absolutely fascinating. So for people that are aware of Scottish football, people will know, obviously, Hearts were relegated last season to the Championship because, unlike the Premier League, the Scottish Premiership did actually finish early because of COVID, and there was, for people that are aware, there was a massive scandal. A lot of teams were affected really badly by that because the league was cut as it was. So Hearts were 4 points adrift at this point when the season was halted because of coronavirus, and that left them 4 points adrift. So after the highly controversial SPFL vote that went on for a long time, Hearts were one of those teams that we were relegated ultimately, and I was someone who was upset about this because Inverness were second in the Championship at the time, so eligible for the playoffs, and they were cancelled as well, so definitely not bitter about that one still. But yeah, no, Hearts is a fascinating one because, as you've said, you'd expect Hearts, when they're coming down, one of the biggest clubs in Scottish football, it isn't really a question in terms of, I believe they're fourth most successful club in Scotland, and Tynecastle, where they play, is one of the top five, top six biggest stadiums in the world, in the country. And so going into the season, you absolutely expect them to be favourites, but I kind of mentioned that their relegation and the circumstances for that, because there's a bit of turmoil there that I think is really relevant to how their season's gone and in the bigger picture. So there was a court battle against the SPFL for the way they handled the coronavirus and the stopping of the season, and Hearts were at the forefront of that for a lot of the summer. And I think that really dominated Hearts' business in the summer. And with that, some of their players were asked to take a wage cut, which is baffling for a club of Hearts' size. And their manager was replaced with Robbie Nielsen. So, and people aren't aware, Robbie Nielsen, he is somewhat of a Championship sort of veteran in terms of, he's assuming Hearts win the title, which is very likely. He's on for his third Championship title. He's actually won it with Hearts before, and Dundee United. But this is a Hearts side that has Craig Gordon, who was playing for Scotland the other day, Craig Halkett and Liam Boyce. These are Premiership players, absolutely. But you kind of alluded to it there. While Hearts, they're comfortably leading the Championship, it's not been all that comfortable. It's kind of been due to some of the inadequacies of the other sides around them. Like, you'd expect Dundee, for example, as you mentioned, to be doing better than they have, but they've had their own troubles. So we kind of mentioned it, the wheels are very much coming off the Hearts brigade almost, in terms of that Brora Rangers result is probably one of the most humiliating in the club's history. This is the Highland League champion, so a big, big difference. And even in the league, ultimately they probably will win the league because the lead they amassed earlier on in the season. And the Scottish Championship is such a baffling league that everyone takes points of everyone. So they did kind of bridge a good gap. But they've only won two of their last nine games. And pretty baffling that they're not involved in. We're going to talk about this briefly. The Scottish Cup, my favourite competition probably. National Cup. I think the Scottish Cup's the best National Cup. And they weren't involved in it, which is baffling for a club of Hearts size. And it's just like, you could argue that it was just this season and it's just a pothole and they'll get through it. But Hearts have, like, on the whole, they've underperformed for the last sort of, I'd say, 7 or 8 years, really, as a powerhouse of Scottish football. Obviously, you don't think they're ever going to overtake the Old Firm, but I mentioned it there. A lot of people probably consider Hearts, along with Hibs and Aberdeen, to be that echelon just below the Old Firm, but they haven't won a major piece of silverware for almost a decade. Like, and in the time, Hearts have failed to win a club. My club, Inverness, St Johnstone, Ross County, St Mirren, they've all won major cups, which is absolutely baffling when you consider those club sizes. And, I mean, even talking about Hibs, you mentioned it there. Hibs are a massive club, and you would argue over the last decade or so, they've underwhelmed compared to Aberdeen. This season aside, they've been absolutely brilliant, but it is really bizarre that those sides can't capitalise on where they are situated in terms of being in Edinburgh, big stadiums, usually have some of the best players in the league as well. But they've both had stints in the Championship recently, Hearts more so than Hibs. It's absolutely baffling because you think you shouldn't really expect a club of Aberdeen, you can understand being ahead of them, but it's absolutely baffling to think that, as I say, like Inverness, St Johnstone, these are ultimately small clubs from Perth and obviously Inverness, like little areas by comparison that shouldn't be overachieving compared to those clubs, because St Johnstone, you'd argue, have had a bigger contribution in Scottish football in the past sort of 8 to 9 years than Hearts have. They've consistently done more on a much smaller budget, and I think it's a real testament to clubs kind of that overconfidence. We kind of talked about the Premier League, it definitely does apply in Scotland. Obviously the Old Firm will always hold the helm, but there's been plenty of clubs to infiltrate the spot below that. I mentioned Inverness, we finished third, Motherwell, St Johnstone themselves. It's definitely not an assumption that Hearts and Hibs will finish as the clubs just below that, which I think as an outsider you definitely expect given the size of those clubs and the history they've had.
How about your own team then, Lewis? You know, you're fighting for playoff position. Inverness going to be on their way up?
I mean, I think so, just in terms of we've hit a bit of a purple patch in terms of we've had our manager, John Robertson, he's on leave at the moment. I think he's had some family issues, but Neil McCann's come in, and someone I was a bit sceptical about and done an absolutely brilliant job in terms of really getting us back on the right track. We've got such a likeable squad at the moment in terms of a young squad, the likes of Daniel Mackay, Cammy Harper, Roddy McGregor. These are young Inverness, born and bred Inverness fans. A lot of them are at the Scottish Cup final, our greatest ever days, an Inverness fan. They were in the stands watching that as fans, and now they're representing the club. People might have seen the Inverness-Ross County Scottish Cup game that was on the other night. Inverness, Championship side against the Premiership outfit, Ross County. You would have thought the roles were reversed, and it's looking really feasible that Inverness will go through the playoffs and Ross County will be the team they face at the end. And the way it's going at the moment, I really fancy Inverness for that game. But in all honesty, I'd probably fancy any team over Ross County or Hamilton at the moment in terms of the Championship, because I don't think the gap is as big as teams say, but I'm obviously backing Inverness for that, yeah.
Good stuff. And Paul, you know, Lewis was mentioning the Scottish Cup there, his favourite competition, I guess, for some of the terrific places that the tournament ends up in and some of the clashes that happen there. I mean, you've been enjoying some of these settings for these games, haven't you?
Oh, absolutely, and I totally agree with what Lewis said there. I think the Scottish FA Cup is the most romantic competition as any of the home nations, but by an absolute mile. And I love the fact that even now, in the games at the weekend were the last 32, and there's three non-league clubs already in the last 32 stage as well, which I think is a reflection of, you know, the breadth and variety within the Scottish Cup. Yeah, man, I always make a point of watching the sports team broadcast whenever the Scottish Cup is on. So, of course, over this morning. And just a few things caught my eye, Lewis, whether they mean anything to you or not quite sure. Well, I saw the Fraserburgh game, and in the corner of the ground, you can see the harbour with the trawler ship backed into the harbour, almost behind the corner flag. I was just fascinated from looking at it. And then watched the Fermanagh team game, which is basically played in a forest with the whole arena surrounded by trees, masses of trees everywhere. And then watched Dumbarton Aberdeen with this massive rock behind the stadium. And then I realised on top of that massive rock is Dumbarton Castle. So what a spectacular scene that is. And then I watched the Border Rangers game and had realised the ground is almost like on the main street and border. And there's a crowd of about 100 people standing on the embankment getting a free view of the game, unobstructed. I thought you just wouldn't get this in the FA Cup. It was just so uplifting because for some of these towns in Scotland, I guess it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity of putting themselves on the map and they want to make the most of it. And I just love the number of shots of some of those non-league teams with fans in the trees trying to get a view of the game. That was in Full Martin where there was, you know, there was people risking life and limb to try and get a look at the game. So I just think the Scottish Cup is fabulous. And unlike the English Cup, which in the past few years has been dominated by the same four or five teams, as you outlined there before, the number of teams who've won the Scottish FA Cup since the turn of the century, it's a good reflection of how competitive that competition is. I think even Gretna made the Scottish Cup final one season as well. So it just goes to show, of all the domestic cup competitions, arguably the Scottish FA Cup is A, the most romantic, and B, the most open.
Definitely. There's a romanticism that exists in the Scottish Cup that I don't think exists in the FA Cup. The term that's been coined for the FA Cup in England is the magic of the cup. I don't think that's really there. I don't believe in that. I don't feel like there's the magic there of just the diversity. Ultimately, it's good and fun. There's a scalp one or two, but ultimately it's the same few teams that win it.
Yeah.
It certainly isn't the case like that in the Scottish Cup in terms of it means just as much to Celtic winning it as it does Inverness, as it does St Johnston. It's such a brilliant cup, and you've got that high quality football in terms of one of the ties for the next round is actually the Old Firm. So that's the fourth round. So we're going to have one of the Old Firm knocked out. But also, you have the likes of Morton through in the next round, Forfar through in the next round. And it's just something that I don't think you really get with the English FA Cup. And I will maintain, and I will argue anyone with it, that the Scottish FA Cup is the best domestic tournament.
Yeah. With you on that.
I'm glad you agree.
Fabulous. Well argued. Well, on a slightly different theme then, Matthew, there's recent news from Belgium on the idea of a cross-border league being mooted, a supposed Beneliga combining the best team from Belgium and the Netherlands. And this is actually an idea I personally quite like as a means of strengthening leagues while countering the sort of ceaseless focus on the big teams of the Champions League. You know, the big clubs of countries like Belgium and the Netherlands have been a bit left behind somewhat since their leagues are obviously slightly weaker than England, Germany, France, etc. You know, Ajax have their flirtations with the top table but can't hold on to their players. Feyenoord, PSV, Anderlecht, Standard Liège and so on. You know, they could benefit from such a change. What do you think of this idea overall, Matthew? And is it something, if it goes ahead in the future, and it's very much an if at this stage, could it be repeated in other places? So, you know, Central Europe, the Balkans, Scandinavia and so on.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's an interesting development. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that it could change football forever. I mean, it's partly a financial decision. Deloitte reckon that they could generate marketing and TV rights of up to $476 million a year, which is a really significant improvement for both Belgium and Dutch clubs. It would also mean that teams would be playing stronger opponents, which would benefit the league and benefit national sides. The idea is that top six clubs from Holland, so Ajax, PSV, Feyenoord, AZ Alkmaar, Utrecht and Vitesse, would join with the top five clubs from Belgium, Anderlecht, Bruges, Standard Liège, Ghent and Genk, with the remaining seven spots being determined by results over the past five seasons. There would be 10 Dutch clubs and 8 Belgian clubs, and then they could still have regional tiers below to, you know, to ensure that split stays the same. I have no idea if it will work. and it would be a shame to lose the independent leagues, but it's interesting and it could help clubs in that region bridge the financial gap to the bigger clubs in Europe. It's something that could have consequences beyond the Belgian and Dutch borders. I mean, I'm sure other nations around the world will be keeping an eye on it to see if it's a success. They do it in rugby. And I don't think it wouldn't affect the top five leagues, but you know, some of the smaller leagues, like you said, in the Baltics, like maybe there could be a Celtic league, I don't know. I think it's interesting, and I really think it could usher in a new age of football and really have a really significant impact on the future of football.
It's certainly one to keep an eye on going forward. I mean, it's definitely an idea I've talked about in the past when we've had Super League discussions, of, you know, different ways it could go rather than just focusing on the elite, is try to raise the profile or the standard or the resource of these huge clubs that have been basically left behind by the modern game. And yes, this can come to other markets. You know, you could imagine, you know, Switzerland and Austria or whatever, maybe Hungary as well, you know, joining a league between the top clubs there would raise the profile similarly. Same Norway, Sweden, Denmark, etc. And that's before you even consider the former Yugoslav nations and so on and how strong they used to be. So I think it's definitely an interesting one. I personally, you know, the ramifications could be huge, as you say. I was really pleased when I saw it. So I hope it comes to fruition and actually works out, because this might actually lead to greater competition across Europe rather than it getting isolated in the few, as seems to be the way things are going at the top. But we shall see. Anyway, let's change focus again now. So it's the chance for my guests to set the agenda so they can pick a subject of their own, a soapbox moment, a bit of a rant, a little bit of praise. Anything you like. So, Paul, I will come to you first.
Yeah, just on the Vanton thing. I mean, AD Ruvoid, England under-21s, what a mess. What's going on? How did the guy get the job in the first place? How can an under-21 team that features likes of Ramsdale for Sheffield United, Ben Godfrey, Tom Davies from Everton, Eze from Crystal Palace, Smith Rowe from Arsenal, Eddie Nketiah from Arsenal, how could a team of that quality not qualify to the next stage of the competition? It justifies belief for me. And it begs the whole question, how does a guy whose last job in football was managing Northampton Town, who he took to the bottom of League Two, then suddenly transform into the manager of the England under-21 in the current setup? It's beyond me. And how he gets away with making excuses that he's got the most difficult job in football, it's not his fault, it's the Premier League club's fault. I think it's just a total dereliction of duty for the FA to allow this man to continue in this post for any longer. Get rid of him now, bring someone who knows what they're doing.
Well put. I think, you know, they've failed at the group stage of the last two under-21 tournaments now. I guess you could compare it to when at senior level, Roy Hodgson was kept on after the disastrous 2014 World Cup, and, you know, things went even more disastrous 2 years later. I guess it's similar, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay then, Lewis, I'll come to you next.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got an equally pessimistic subject, but for reasons much worse, unfortunately, just in terms of the kind of bringing it back to Scotland, the Glenn Kamara case that people will know about in the Europa League. Obviously, Rangers playing Slavia Prague, and Andre Cadell is alleged to have racially abused him towards the end of the game. And for people who watched the match, you will have seen there was a bit of a melee in the middle of the pitch. Rangers had sort of well and truly lost the game by this point, with a man sent off, and Rangers were 2-0 down on the night and 3-1. On aggregate. But this, unfortunately, just becomes irrelevant, because you see Cadell sprint down the pitch and then covers his mouth and whispers something to Glenn Kamara, who you can see is visibly upset afterwards, and he alleges that he's been racially abused, and it was absolutely horrific. And in the aftermath of that, both Kamara and Kemar Roof, another Rangers player, were subjected to horrendous racial abuse on social media after the game, which we've seen all too often, unfortunately, this season and seasons past. Worse still, really, was the Slavia ultras were seen outside the stadium, and they were holding a racist banner towards Kamara. So this is premeditated and calculated and absolutely horrific. But to try and take some form of silver lining from the aftermath, Steven Gerrard and the way he stood up for his player was so commendable, and he asked some really good questions about UEFA in the process, and he absolutely took no attempt in his post-match press conference and in the aftermath to try and deflect from the result. He credited Slavia Prague for the win and was like, ultimately, things are more important than football, which we would all absolutely agree on that this is, and really asked questions about UEFA that I think a lot of us are really thinking in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement and the lack of action, I think we would say, from UEFA. Also, Conor Goldson, Rangers centre half. You could see how visibly shook he was as well, and the way, the pure anger he had towards these players. It's absolutely horrific that these people wanting to play football, do the thing that they love, are subjected to this just for ultimately doing their job. But I wanted to sort of talk about how this has been looked upon in Scotland afterwards. And I mean, support for Scotland in the most part has been incredibly positive, Michael Stewart aside, in terms of fans and teams really getting together to support Kamara, which is something that's really positive, because you do worry sometimes with the old firm allegiances that some people would overlook this abuse and take it to tribalism. But fortunately, that's not been seen. And we've seen really nice things from the wider Scottish community, football community, in terms of Hibs players and the Motherwell chief exec saying their support for Kamara. But I think the thing that the real moment that it really, like, the Scottish people really felt united, I mentioned that old firm allegiance and the worry there, in terms of people taking it far too tribal and worrying about things that are ultimately irrelevant, because it's all about this poor man has been racially abused. Is the next game that was played was the Old Firm, and the embrace that Scott Brown, he crosses the halfway line in the pre-match warm-ups to embrace Glenn Kamara, was a massive thing in Scottish football. You think about the rivalry between these two clubs, but to see Scott Brown, Celtic skipper, to go over and embrace Glenn Kamara was absolutely huge. And Brown sort of talked about himself. He was like, he's absolutely disgusted what happened. And he was like saying that it doesn't matter whether it's a Ranger or a Celtic player, it should never be part of the game. And that he stands with Kamara, which I think is absolutely massive. And something that I think we just really need to keep putting the message out there, that this is so much bigger than football. And I'm really glad that people could put allegiances aside about football clubs and who they support, because this is more important.
Yeah, absolutely. Matthew?
Just to add to that, there's unfortunately been a similar incident in Spain this evening where a Cadiz player has racially abused Diakabi, plays for Valencia. And the reaction to that has, well, I mean, already the how that was handled in the game was not handled well, where Diakabi was actually subbed off and the Cadiz player has been allowed to carry on playing the game. I have a feeling the reaction in Spain is not going to be as good as it is in Scotland. I think that you are reckoning on this sort of thing in Spain. But it's important to highlight that sort of stuff. But I totally agree with what Lewis said. The reaction in Scotland has been warming and, like, really good, especially the Scott Brown thing.
Absolutely. Especially in the heat of an All Firm, the build-up to an All Firm battle. That's very, very good to see, wasn't it? Well, let's stick with you, Matthew, then. It's your moment now.
Yeah, so last week, Ireland lost to Luxembourg in the World Cup qualifiers, leading to quite a reaction in the media. A lot of people claiming it to be the most embarrassing result in Irish football history. But don't get me wrong, it's not a good result. But there's been some quite dramatic statements, especially considering how Luxembourg have improved as a footballing nation in recent years, both internationally and domestically, while Ireland have severely declined. Luxembourg, for their part, have risen to 98th in the world rankings. They are no longer the whipping boys they used to be. They have clubs like Dudelange regularly qualifying for the Europa League now. And their international squad is made up of players like Leandro Barriero, Florian Boner, who both play for Mainz in Germany, Daniel Sinani, who is at he's in Belgium on loan from Norwich, and that winner last week was scored by Gerson Rodriguez, who plays for Dynamo Kiev. In contrast, Ireland's keeper Gavin Bazin, who plays for Rochdale in League One. Ireland, on the other hand, have totally wasted the last decade. They have made no tangible efforts to improve the quality of their national side. To really highlight this, the biggest selling book in Ireland last year was Champagne Football, a book about John Delaney's scandalous reign over the FAI. And I don't mean the biggest selling, like, specialist sports book. I mean the biggest selling book in Ireland, which is extraordinary and really highlights what a farce the FAI have been over the last, like, decade, maybe more. It's not just Luxembourg, though. I think Georgia gave Spain a game last week. They're another country on the rise. Armenia, atop of a group with Germany, who were beaten by North Macedonia last week. Hungary and Iceland are ones we already know, but are nations that have improved in the past to a point of where we think of them as good teams now. Ireland losing to Luxembourg was not a good result, but hardly the embarrassment it initially appeared to be.
Agreed.
Yeah, absolutely spot on. Well, on other areas, we are as busy as ever across the various platforms at these Football Times. There's more magazines in the pipeline, so keep your eyes peeled for that in the coming weeks. And also the possibility of another old favourite being reprinted, which is always popular. On the podcast front, the first Envenera series is recently finished, and coming soon will be the South America Files with a magnificent expert guest for fascinating look at football in each of the South American countries. Plus, there's a host of other podcasts too, so do check those out or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. But we will finish there for tonight. So thanks to everyone for their great contributions as always. Paul, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ethan. Thanks for hosting the show so impeccably again. And thanks to Matthew and Lewis for their contributions. I found out loads of things I didn't know this evening. So thanks, guys. Really enjoyed the whole evening.
Well, we always like to educate, and we educate each other as much as anybody else, possibly. Matthew, thank you to you too.
Thanks for having us on, and thanks for giving us time to talk about Blues.
We all need that therapy. I feel like we're soul brothers at the moment, Matthew, with our struggles. And Lewis, thanks to you too. On a more positive note for you and your team.
Oh, very welcome. It's been an absolute pleasure as always. And I mean, I think I try and fit an Inverness comment into every single Today's Football Times that I've been on. So I've definitely done that tonight. So yeah, no, it's been a brilliant one.
We'll do an Inverness special one day.
Definitely.
And thank you to all our listeners too. I hope you've enjoyed the discussion, and you'll join us again next time on these Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.